From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Al-Shabaab gunmen attack a university in Kenya. The UN Human Rights Chief blasts the Thai junta's new security order. And new research indicates writer Anne Frank died 1 month earlier than originally estimated.
She was a victim of the Holocaust of Bergen-Belsen, and she didn't have any chance to survive.
It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack on a university in northeastern Kenya that has killed at least 70 people and injured many others. VOA's Gabe Joselo reports many students are still believed to be trapped inside as security forces conduct operations to flush out the militants.
Officials say gunmen attacked Garissa University College early Thursday morning, killing two guards on their way in. A statement from Kenya's chief of police says the assailants fired indiscriminately as they entered campus. Witnesses say they started near the classrooms and then proceeded to the residence halls, where they are believed to be holding hostages. Kenyan Interior Secretary Joseph Nkasari said more than 500 students at the university remain unaccounted for, while all of the staff are reported to be safe. In an address, President Uhuru Kenyatta offered his condolences to the families of victims.
We continue to pray for the quick recovery of the injured and the safe rescue of those still being held hostage.
The president also announced that he would fast-track the training of 10,000 additional police, saying the country has suffered unnecessarily due to shortage of security personnel. It is still unknown how many gunmen are involved in the attack. Officials say one suspect has been arrested. Kenyan authorities have named alleged Al-Shabaab commander Mohamed Kuno as the mastermind of the attack. A security brief seen by VOA says Kuno was a former madrasa teacher in Garissa before joining the Somali militant group. The town of Garissa in northeastern Kenya is about 200 kilometers from the border with Somalia and has, in recent years, been the site of sporadic gun and grenade attacks blamed on Al-Shabaab. Students at the university say they were awakened by gunfire Thursday at around 5 in the morning. First-year student Mercy Chibet told VOA she was able to escape by running through a field and climbing over a fence. She said she has spoken by phone to some friends still trapped inside with the gunmen.
They are inside, they have been held inside, and the policemen are outside. We don't know what will happen next.
VOA obtained a security memo circulated last week at the University of Nairobi, warning students and faculty that Al-Shabaab was planning an attack on a major university. It is not clear if Garissa University received or posted the same warning. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. An announcement is expected shortly regarding the continuing international negotiations on Iran's nuclear program that is taking place in Lausanne, Switzerland. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins joins me now. Pam, is it known what kind of announcement is coming?
We're expecting word soon on an announcement of an outline and a path of understanding that will allow the talks to continue. As you know, the negotiators, Iran, and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in Germany were originally hoping to have this agreement by their self-imposed deadline of March 31st. They have continued talking. Now there's word that we will get an initial statement, perhaps from the EU representative and Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, and possibly later a statement from Secretary of State Kerry.
Is it known at the moment what kind of stumbling blocks these negotiations have faced?
That's an interesting question. Throughout the week of talks in Switzerland, foreign ministers and Secretary Kerry have said that they are optimistic about their progress, but that key sticking points remain. We know that some of those tough issues have been uranium enrichment levels. Also, another tough issue has been a timeline for reducing sanctions. Iran has pushed for an immediate relief from sanctions if there is an overall agreement, whereas some of the world powers have pushed for more of a gradual release from sanctions.
Now, certainly these talks have been going on quite a while. Apparently, there has been observations that they've been going on longer than any negotiations since 1919 at the end of World War I in Paris, that is for the Americans. I guess it's because of the continuing concerns about verification that this has been going on.
Absolutely. And these have been tough negotiations. As you mentioned, they started before this week, and this is a process that really kicked into high gear after the negotiators missed a November deadline. It'll be interesting going forward to see what kind of progress they can make on these key issues if there is indeed word of a continuing round of talks after today's announcement. It'll be interesting to see what kind of progress they can make before their end of June deadline.
All right. Thanks very much. That's Pam Dawkins at the State Department. The Arab League has unveiled a proposal for a unified military force that could counter growing regional security threats such as Yemen and Libya. The final communique of last week's Arab League summit called for coordination, efforts, and steps to establish such a unified force to defend the Arab national security. There's no word on when or how such a force could be coordinated among Arab countries with diverse and sometimes conflicting interests. But there is general agreement that something must be done, considering the troubles in Syria, Yemen, and Libya, and the potential for a surge in Islamic militancy in Egypt. VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke to Arab League Ambassador Mohammed Al-Husseini about the Arab summit resolve towards such challenges.
I hope it will lead to a political dialogue, and this is our objective from this operation, a decisive storm operation. We would not really like to have a proxy war with Iran there, but we went there to Yemen upon the request of the legitimate president. And of course, according to the United Nations Article 51 and according to the Arab League Charter also, and also the Arab League Treaty of Joint Defense. But our objective really, as Saudi Arabia is spearheading the coalition now of more than 10 countries, is to force the Houthis, the pro-Iranian Houthis, to withdraw from the cities and the institutions they occupied and to submit their weapons.
Does the wide support for establishing a joint Arab force to protect the Arab national security end relying on the U.S. to intervene militarily in Arab regional conflicts?
Perhaps it's a blessing that the United States is reluctant to go into or to participate in any conflict in the region. Like now, you see Saudi Arabia is heading the coalition without the United States participation. But the United States is providing logistic and, as it's not a secret, logistic and intelligence services. But really, I think Saudi Arabia and the countries who are in the coalition, I think they can make it without any help of any superpower.
The Arab leaders also supported the legitimate government in Libya. How does that serve the United Nations mediation when the summit seemed to have supported one side of the conflict against the other?
You know, in Libya, the situation is very complicated. When the revolution took over, there were no institutions whatsoever in Libya, and that's why you have these tribal factions here and there and equipped with weapons they got during the revolution. So it's very complicated. Of course, the Arab countries, with the mediation of the UN, they are trying to solve the problem and to have a more strong legitimate government there.
The Arab summit called on the UN to deal with the crisis in Syria to reach a political solution based on Geneva One conference. Negotiations would eventually include the Syrian government.
Yeah.
Why not consider the Syrian government as a part of the solution, not only as a part of the problem?
It's very difficult to consider the Syrian government as part of the solution because it's the one that caused all the problems after the killing of more than 200,000 and maybe displaced and refugees of 12 million Syrians. I don't think this government will have any legitimacy or it is accepted by any Syrian groups or by the opposition. So it's out of the question that this regime should be removed and it shouldn't be there because it is the problem and not only part. It is the main problem is the regime.
Arab League Ambassador Mohammed Al-Husseini speaking with Mohammed El-Shenawi. Thailand's lifting of martial law is meaningless, according to the top UN official for human rights, who has swiftly reacted with alarm. VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok has details.
Less than 24 hours after Thailand's junta replaced martial law with a special security order, the UN human rights chief issued a scathing statement. High Commissioner for Human Rights Zaid Raad Al-Hussein blasted Thailand's government for a move he called even more draconian than martial law. In Geneva, UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA that normally the lifting of martial law in a country would be applauded.
The problem is they've replaced it with something that's even worse, essentially, more draconian, not least because it's vaguer and more sort of all-encompassing. So it's really very worrying because it could lead to quite large-scale human rights violations with total impunity and gives quite extraordinary powers even to junior military officers in their dealings with civilians.
The High Commissioner's statement says the imposition of Article 44 of Thailand's interim charter allows the junta's boss, Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, to issue any legislative, executive, or judicial order. A Thai government advisor on security affairs, Panitan Watanayagorn, argues the UN official does not understand what really happened with 17 martial law regulations swept aside.
Last night there were 14 regulations being issued to curb the power of the martial law. And that's the point that's missed by the United Nations High Commissioner, I think.
High Commissioner's aide's statement asserted the junta has swept away all checks and balances on the power of the government. Spokesman Colville says the UN Human Rights Office is also alarmed by the authority military officers now have to prohibit the reporting of news.
The High Commissioner actually describes this as annihilating freedom of expression. They can also restrict the sale and distribution of books, publications, and on the very, very vague grounds, just a suggestion that the book or the newspaper or whatever may create public fear or is intended to distort news and information. That's incredibly easy to abuse.
Freedom of assembly also remains severely curtailed, with heavy punishment for protesters who gather in groups of more than five. The High Commissioner's statement concludes by urging Thailand to comply with its obligations under international human rights law and promptly restore normal civilian rule of law as it pledged to do after the coup in May last year. Then Army Chief Prayut declared martial law on May 20th and 2 days later ousted the civilian government in a bloodless coup, the latest in a long series of such interventions by the military. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Muhammadu Buhari made history in Nigeria this week by unseating incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan in a democratic vote. Now comes the hard part, making good on the promises he made on the campaign trail. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja.
Change. It was the word printed on billboards, shouted at rallies, and uttered in greeting among supporters of Mr. Buhari and his All Progressives Congress Party. And it worked. Mr. Buhari got 2.5 million votes more than Mr. Jonathan, whose campaign centered on the idea of continuing his transformation agenda. Political commentator Chris Ngwodo says the president-elect's slogan was a powerful rhetorical tool.
There was no doubt about the argument for change in terms of juxtaposing the incumbent president with the president-elect. There was no argument. Buhari certainly represents a departure from him, both in style, in substance, and in temperament as well.
Now he has to deliver. Mr. Buhari's promises include an end to the Boko Haram insurgency, which has ravaged the country's northeast in its quest to impose strict Islamic law. He also campaigned on cutting down corruption and implementing universal health care. But when he takes office in May, Chuba Ezekwesili, a research analyst at the Nigeria Economic Summit Group, says Mr. Buhari will inherit a government that is borrowing to pay its bills and still has not passed a 2015 budget. Social spending promises, like universal health care, may end up on the back burner.
I mean, the majority of our budget is in recurrent expenditure, which is essentially to say to pay salaries. So, I mean, if we're already at the point where we're borrowing money from the World Bank to pay for the 2015 salary, then it shows that we're already in a bad situation.
Much of Mr. Buhari's campaign centered on snuffing out Boko Haram, but the militant group is perhaps at its lowest point in years. The Nigerian military, with help from foreign mercenaries and troops from neighboring countries, has over the past weeks chased the militants out of almost all of the towns they overran in the northeast. Don Demowo, a Nigeria-based analyst for Africa Practice Consultancy, says it will be up to Mr. Buhari to figure out how to put the group down for good.
So I don't know if it means creating some kind of something similar to the Niger Delta Commission to address specific issues in that part of the country or something of the sort, but something really that addresses, you know, the peculiar issues of people in that part of the country, the kind of environment that would allow that kind of radical ideology to foster and develop to the point that, this group is able to take over a part of the country.
Any solution will have to address the social and economic problems fueling the insurgency, Damoho says. But cash is short, and Damoho says tackling those problems may have to wait. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Super Typhoon Maysak, has weakened as it moves west toward the Philippines, where it's expected to make landfall Sunday or Monday. The storm with sustained winds of 260 kilometers per hour slammed into two of the four island chains of the Pacific Federated States of Micronesia from March 29th through the 31st, leaving at least five people dead, damaging most buildings and destroying crops and soil. Bill Stinnett operates the Truck Stop Hotel on Weno Island in the state of Chuuk, about two-thirds of the way between Hawaii and Indonesia. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty he had never experienced such a storm before.
You know, I've been there 37 years, and this is by far the worst storm that I've ever seen, witnessed, experienced there. We had something years ago that caused landslides that killed 49 people, but not nearly the amount of property damage that was done this time. And what made this typhoon unique is that it bashed us with winds that must have been at least 70 miles an hour for a couple of hours. And then, for the first time in my life, I experienced the eye. And in a span of about 2 minutes, the wind died completely down. I thought the sun was going to come out, and for about 20 minutes, it was a nice day. And then the wind came from the exact opposite direction. Within several minutes, it was worse than the first couple of hours that we experienced.
Most concrete structures reportedly withstood the fury of the storm, but everything else was damaged.
Yeah, what happened was the houses made of plywood and tin, they are basically gone. You know, some in a shelter for some reason or whatever survived, but if it was a plywood tin house, then it's severely damaged. The ones that were cement but had tin roof, they've lost their roof. Our hotel survived. We lost about 20 feet of our cement wooden dock. And again, this dock has survived for 20 years in some pretty bad weather. This was just intense. And what's happening now is the stores that had the material needed to fix homes and stuff, nails, screws, plywood, tin roofing, lumber, they're not selling it. They're holding it to fix their own damage, or they're holding it for their family members who need things fixed. So there's a problem probably right now where families can't stay in their home because they have no roof and they can't acquire the material to get it fixed. And that's where I think our need really is.
Bill Stennett operates the Truck Stop Hotel on Weno Island.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's premier newsmaker interview program. If you have ideas for guests or topics or want to comment on one of our programs, please write to us at Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Press Conference USA, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is pcusa@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. New research conducted by the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam suggests the famous author of The Diary of a Young Girl died a month earlier than originally estimated. Historians previously thought Anne died at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany in March 1945, but now researchers believe she died in February. Anne and her family went into hiding in the secret annex in July 1942. A Jewish family, they were attempting to evade Nazi authorities who had seized control of the Netherlands. The Franks and the other occupants of the annex were discovered and arrested in August 1944. Anne and her family were sent to the Westerbork transit camp and then to Auschwitz in Poland. In November, Anne and her sister Margot were sent to Bergen-Belsen. Erica Prinz is an historian and researcher at the Anne Frank House. I asked her what prompted the new study released on the 70th anniversary of Anne's death.
Police shootings during violent confrontations in minority neighborhoods have sparked national protests.
Justice! Now!
Police have also been targets of the violence, and federal officials and local police have been looking for ways to avoid deadly confrontations.
The history of Anne Frank and the other hiders in the secret annex at the Prinsengracht in Amsterdam is subject of ongoing research of the Anne Frank House. And this new research is part of a bigger research to the history or the whereabouts, what happened of all the hiders during the time they were in the camp. So after they were arrested, they went to Westerbork, they went to Auschwitz, and what happened to them. So this is only a small part of it.
Originally, I know Anne and her sister Margot and her mother were at Auschwitz, and then later Anne and her sister went to Bergen-Belsen. But apparently, when they got there, they were not selected to perform labor there. I mean, does this suggest they were already too weak?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, well, there were all the women who went from Auschwitz to Bergen-Belsen were at first selected to do slave labor in other camps, and some of the women who went with them actually went further on to Ragun, that's a satellite camp of Buchenwald. But Anne and Margot were not selected for this this further transport. So we can only conclude that they were too sick.
Originally, the Dutch Red Cross placed Anne's death around the end of March 1945.
Yes.
And
yes.
The next month, the camp was liberated.
Yes, and, in 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and according to the original figures, you know, Anne came so close to surviving. Now, this latest information suggests she died earlier in February, but still, it was within 2 months of the camp being liberated. Is it known how she died?
She had typhus, and we know what the symptoms are of this illness. Several witnesses tell us that she had typhus, and that's a very, very nasty sickness. And after an incubation period of around a week, you get severe headaches and muscle pain and high fever. There is a statement of a friend who met Anne at the fence of the Sternlager in Bergen-Belsen. And at that time, that's the beginning of February, Margot couldn't leave her bed anymore at that time because she was too sick. Well, that is consistent with this muscle pain and high fever you get with typhus. Well, and then some 5 days later, you get a skin rash and a delirium, and then about 12 days after the first symptoms, people die. And especially, some people survive, but when you are in such bad condition as Anne and Margot must have been, you can't survive it.
The fact that the new research indicates that Anne died about a month, died in February as opposed to March, what is significant about this, the fact that she died a month earlier than was originally thought?
Well, it doesn't change anything on the tragedy of her death and of her sister. It's still very sad, but, you know, sometimes it's sad, well, they died just before the liberation, and if they only had lived a little bit longer, they might have survived. And, well, that's not true. They just died like many, many others during that early period of 1945 in February. Even so, after the liberation, more than 14,000 people still died. You know, it was just, she was a victim of the Holocaust of Bergen-Belsen, and she didn't have any chance to survive.
Erica Prinz, historian and researcher at the Anne Frank House. That's a wonderful book. The Diary of a Young Girl was one of my very favorites as a teenager. And back in 1981, I was able to visit the house, and it's really fascinating. Well, thanks very much for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.